because he had Roe to hold, but some of the younger ones. And she whispered at them to hush when they cried, because she was scared as piss of Cantlis. He'd hit her time to time, and after, when she was wiping the blood from her nose, she'd make excuses for him. She'd say how he'd had a hard life, and been abandoned by his folks, and beaten as a child, and other such. That sounded to Roe like it should make you slower, rather than quicker, to beat others. But she guessed everyone's got their excuses, even if they're feeble ones. The way Roe saw it, Cantlis had nothing in him worth a damn. He rode up front in his fancy tailored clothes, like he was some big man with important doings to be about, instead of a child thief and murderer and lowest of the low, aiming to make himself look special by gathering even lower scum about him for a backdrop. At night, he'd get a great big fire built, because he loved to watch things burn, and he'd drink, and once he'd set to drinking, his mouth would get a bitter twist and he'd complain. About how life weren't fair, and how he'd been tricked out of an inheritance by a banker, and how things never seemed to go his way. They stopped for a day beside wide water flowing, and Roe asked him, "Where are you taking us?" And he just said, "Upstream." A keelboat had tied off at the bank, and upstream they'd gone, poled and roped and rowed by a set of men all sinew while the flat land slid by, and way, way off, north through the haze, three blue peaks showed against the sky. Roe thought at first it would be a mercy not to have to ride no more, but now all they could do was sit. Sit under a canopy up front and watch the water and the land drift past and feel their old lives dwindle further and further off, the faces of the folks they'd known harder to bring to mind, until the past all felt like a dream and the future an unknown nightmare. Blackpoint would get off now and again with his bow, a couple of the others with him, and they'd come back later with meat they'd hunted up. Rest of the time he sat smoking and watched the children and grinned for hours at a spell. When Roe saw the missing teeth in that grin, she thought about him shooting Gully and leaving him swinging there on the tree full of arrows. When she thought about that, she wanted to cry, but she knew she couldn't because she was one of the oldest, and the little ones were looking to her to be strong, and that's what she meant to be. She reckoned if she didn't cry, that was her way of beating them. A little victory, maybe, but Chai always said a win's a win. Few days on the boat, and they saw something burning far off across the grass, plumes of smoke trickling up and fading in that vastness of above, and the black dots of birds circling, circling. The chief boatman said they should turn back, and he was worried about ghosts, and Cantlis just laughed and shifted the knife in his belt and said there was things closer at hand for a man to worry on, and that was all the conversation. That evening, one of the men had shaken her wakeful and started talking about how she reminded him of someone, smiling, though there was something wrong in his eye and his breath sour with spirits, and he'd caught hold of her arm, and Pitt had hit him hard as he could, which wasn't that hard. B woke and screamed, and Cantlis came and dragged the man away, and Blackpoint kicked him till he stopped moving, and tossed him in the river. Cantlis shouted at the others to leave the goods well alone, and just use their fucking hands, 'cause no bastard would be costing him money, you could bet on that. She knew she should never have said nothing about it, but she couldn't help herself then, and she'd burst out, "My sister's following, you can bet on that if you want to bet. She'll find you out." She'd thought Cantlis might hit her then, but all he'd done was look at her like she was the latest of many afflictions fate had forced upon him, and said, "Little one, the past is gone, like to that water flowing by. The sooner you put it from your pinprick of a mind, the happier you'll be. You got no sister now. No one's following." And he went off to stand on the prow, tutting as he tried to rub the spotted blood out of his fancy clothes with a damp rag.
"Is it true?" Pitt asked her. "Is no one following?" Shy's following.
Roe never doubted it, because, you'd best believe, Shy was not a person to be told how things would be. But what Roe didn't say was that she half hoped Shy wasn't following, because she didn't want to see her sister shot through with arrows, and she didn't really know what she could do about all this, because even with the three that left, and the two that took most of the horses off to sell when they got on the boat, and the one that Blackpoint killed, Cantlus still had 13 men. She didn't see what anyone could do about it. She wished Lamb was with them, though, because he could have smiled and said, "It's all right, don't worry none," like he did when there was a storm and she couldn't sleep. That would have been fine. Part 2. Fellowship. What a wild life, and what a fresh kind of existence. But ah, the discomforts. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Conscience and the Cockrot. Praying? Sophine sighed.
No. I am kneeling here with my eyes closed, cooking porridge. Yes, I am praying.
He opened one eye a crack and aimed it at Temple.
Care to join me?
I don't believe in God, remember? Temple realized he was picking at the hem of his shirt again and stopped himself. Can you honestly say he ever raised a finger to help you?
You don't have to like God to believe. Besides, I know I am past help.
What do you pray for, then?
Sophine dabbed his face with his prayer cloth, eyeing Temple over the fringe.
I pray for you, brother. You look as if you need it.
I've been feeling a little jumpy.
Temple realized he was worrying at his sleeve now and tore his hand away. For God's sake, would his fingers not be happy until they had unraveled every shirt he possessed?
Do you ever feel as if there is a dreadful weight hanging over you?
Often.
And that it might fall at any moment?
All the time.
And you just don't know how to get out from under it?
But you do know.
There was a pause while they watched each other.
No, said Temple, taking a step away. No, no.
The old man listens to you.
No.
You could talk to him, get him to stop this.
I tried. He didn't want to hear.
Perhaps you didn't try hard enough.
Temple clapped his hands over his ears, and Sophine dragged them away.
The easy way leads nowhere.
You talk to him, then.
I'm just a scout.
I'm just a lawyer. I never claimed to be a righteous man.
No righteous man does.
Temple tore himself free and strode off through the trees.
If God wants this stopped, let him stop it. Isn't he all-powerful?
Never leave to God what you can do yourself,
he heard Sophine call and hunched his shoulders as though the words were slingstones. The man was starting to sound like Cardia. Temple only hoped things didn't end the same way. Certainly no one else in the company appeared keen to avoid violence. The woods were alive with eager fighting men, tightening worn-out straps, sharpening weapons, stringing bows. A pair of Northmen were slapping each other to pink-faced heights of excitement. A pair of Cantics were at prayers of their own, kneeling before a blessing stone they had placed with great care on a tree stump the wrong way up. Every man takes God for his ally, regardless of which way he faces. The towering wagon had been drawn up in a clearing, its hard-working horses at their nosebags. Cosca was draped against one of its wheels, outlining his vision for the attack on Avastok to an assembly of the company's foremost members, switching smoothly between Styrian and Common, and with expressive gestures of hand and hat,
for the benefit of those who spoke neither. Swarbrick crouched over a boulder beside him, with pencil poised to record the great man at work.
"So that Captain Dimbic's Union contingent can sweep in from the west alongside the river."
"Yes, sir," pronounced Dimbic, sweeping a few well-greased hairs back into position with a licked little finger.
"Braccio will simultaneously bring his men charging in from the east."
"Simul to what now?"
grunted the Styrian, tonguing at a rotten tooth.
"At the same time," said Friendly.
"Ah, and Joubert will thrust downhill from the trees, completing the encirclement."
The feather on Koska's hat thrashed as it achieved a metaphorical total victory over the forces of darkness.
"Let no one escape," ground out Lawson. "Everyone must be examined."
"Of course."
Koska pushed out his lower jaw and scratched thoughtfully at his neck, where a faint speckling of pink rash was appearing.
"And all plunder declared, assessed, and properly noted, so that it may be divided according to the rule of quarters. Any questions?"
"How many men will Inquisitor Lawson torture to death today?"
demanded Sufine in ringing tones. Temple stared at him open-mouthed, and he was not alone. Koska went on scratching.
"I was thinking of questions relating to our tactics."
"As many as is necessary," interrupted the Inquisitor. "You think I revel in this? The world is a grey place, a place of half-truths, of half-wrongs and half-rights. Yet there are things worth fighting for, and they must be pursued with all our vigour and commitment. Half-measures achieve nothing."
"What if there are no rebels down there?"
Sufine shook off Temple's frantic tugging at his sleeve.
"What if you are wrong?"
"Sometimes I will be," said Lawson simply. "Courage lies in bearing the costs. We all have our regrets, but not all of us can afford to be crippled by them. Sometimes it takes small crimes to prevent bigger ones. Sometimes the lesser evil is the greater good. A man of principle must make hard choices and suffer the consequences. Or you could sit and cry over how unfair it all is."
"Works for me," said Temple with a laugh of choking falseness.
"It will not work for me."
Sufine wore a strange expression, as if he was looking through the gathering to something in the far distance, and Temple felt an awful foreboding, even more awful than usual.
"General Koska, I want to go down into Avostok."
"So do we all. Did you not hear my address?"
"Before the attack."
"Why?" demanded Lawson.
"To talk to the townsfolk," said Sufine. "To give them a chance to surrender any rebels."
Temple winced. God, it sounded ridiculous. Noble, righteous, courageous, and ridiculous.
"To avoid what happened in Square Deal."
Koska was taken aback.
"I thought we were remarkably well behaved in Square Deal. A company of kittens could have been no gentler. Would you not say so, Swarbrick?"
The writer adjusted his eyeglasses and stammered out,
"Admirable restraint."
"This is a poor town."
Sufine pointed into the trees with a faintly shaking finger.
"They have nothing worth taking."
Dimbic frowned as he scraped at a stain on his sash with a fingernail.
"You can't know that until you look." "Just give me a chance, I'm begging you."
Sufine clasped his hands and looked Koska in his eye.
"I'm praying."
"Prayer is arrogance," intoned Joubert. "The hope of man to change the will of God. But God's plan is set, and his words already spoken."
"Fuck him then,"
snapped Sufine. Joubert mildly raised one brow.
"Oh, you will find it is God who does the fucking."
There was a pause, the metallic notes of martial preparations drifting between the tree trunks along with the morning birdsong. The old man sighed and rubbed at the bridge of his nose.
"You sound determined,"
Sufine echoed Lawson's words.
"A man of principle must make hard choices and suffer the consequences."
"And if I agree to this, what then? Will your conscience continue to prick at our asses all the way across the near country and back? Because that could become decidedly tiresome. Conscience can be painful, but so can the cockrot. A grown-up should suffer his afflictions privately and not allow them to become an inconvenience for friends and colleagues."
"Conscience and the cockrot are hardly equivalent," snapped Lawson.
"Indeed," said Koska significantly. "The cockrot is rarely fatal."
The Inquisitor's face had turned even more livid than usual.
"Am I to understand you are considering this folly?"
"You are, and I am. The town is surrounded, after all. No one is going anywhere. Perhaps this can make all our lives a little easier. What do you think, Temple?"
Temple blinked.
"Me?
I am looking at you and using your name."
"Yes, but me?"
There was a good reason why he had stopped making hard choices. He always made the wrong ones. 30 years of scraping through the poverty and fear between disasters to end up in this fix was proof enough of that. He looked from Sufine to Koska to Lawson and back. Where was the greatest profit? Where the least danger? Who was actually right? It was damn difficult to pick the easy way from this tangle.
"Well,"
Koska puffed out his cheeks.
"The man of conscience and the man of doubts. God help us indeed. You have 1 hour."
"I must protest," barked Lawson.
"If you must, you must. But I won't be able to hear you with all this noise."
"What noise?"
Koska stuck his fingers in his ears.
"Bla-li-la-li-la-li-la-li-la."
He was still doing it as Temple hurried away through the towering trees after Sufine, their boots crunching on fallen sticks, rotten cones, browned pine needles, the sound of the men fading to leave only the rustling of the branches high above, the twitter and warble of birds.
"Have you gone mad?"
hissed Temple, struggling to keep up.
"I have gone sane."
"What will you do?"
"Talk to them."
"To who?"
"Whoever will listen."
"You won't put the world right with talk."
"What will you use then? Fire and sword? Papers of engagement?"
They passed the last group of puzzled sentries, Bermi giving a questioning look from among them, and Temple offering only a helpless shrug in return. Then they were out into the open, sunlight suddenly bright on their faces. The few dozen houses of Avastok clung to a curve in the river below. Houses was being generous to most of them. They were little better than shacks, with dirt between. They were no better than shacks, with shit between, and Sufine was already striding purposefully downhill in their direction.
"What the hell is he up to?"
hissed Bermi from the shadowy safety of the trees.
"I think he's following his conscience," said Temple.
The Styrian looked unconvinced.
"Conscience is a shitty navigator.
I've often told him so."
Yet Sufine showed no sign of slowing in his pursuit of it.
"Oh, God,"
muttered Temple, wincing up at the blue heavens.
"Oh, God, oh, God."
And he bounded after, grass thrashing about his calves, patched with little white flowers, the names of which he did not know.
"Self-sacrifice is not a noble thing,"
he called as he caught up.
"I have seen it, and it's an ugly, pointless thing, and nobody thanks you for it."
"Perhaps God will."
"If there is a God, he has bigger things to worry about than the likes of us."
Sufine pressed on, looking neither left or right.
"Go back, Temple. This is not the easy way."
"That I fucking realize."
He caught a fistful of Sufine's sleeve.
"Let's both go back."
Sufine shook him off and carried on.
"No."
"Then I'm coming."
"Good."
"Fuck."
Temple hurried to catch up again, the town getting steadily closer and looking less and less like a thing he wished to risk his life for.
"What's your plan?"
"There is a plan, yes?"
"There is. Part of one."
"That's not very reassuring."
"Reassuring you was not my aim."
"Then you have fucking succeeded, my friend." They passed under the arch of rough-trimmed timbers that served for a gate, a sign creaking beneath it that read Avestock. They skirted around the boggiest parts of the boggy main street, between the slumping little buildings, most of warped pine, all on one story, and some barely that.
"God, this is a poor place," muttered Sophine.
"It puts me in mind of home," whispered Temple, which was far from a good thing. The sun-baked lower city of Dagoska, the seething slums of Styria, the hard-scrabble villages of the near country. Every nation was rich in its own way, but poor in the same. A woman skinned a fly-blown carcass that might have been rabbit or cat, and Temple got the feeling she was not bothered which. A pair of half-naked children mindlessly banged wooden swords together in the street. A long-haired ancient whittled a stick on the stoop of one of the few stone-built houses, a sword that was definitely not a toy leaning against the wall behind him. They all watched Temple and Sophine with sulky suspicion. Some shutters clattered closed, and Temple's heart started to pound. Then a dog barked, and he nearly shat, sweat standing cold on his brow as a stinking breeze swept past. He wondered if this was the stupidest thing he had ever done in a life littered with idiocy. High on the list, he decided, and still with ample time to bully its way to the top. Avestock's glittering heart was a shed with a tankard painted on a board above the entrance and a luckless clientele. A pair who looked like a farmer and his son, both red-haired and bony, the boy with a satchel over his shoulder, sat at one table, eating bread and cheese far from the freshest. A tragic fellow decked in fraying ribbons was bent over a cup. Temple took him for a travelling bard, and hoped he specialised in sad songs, because the sight of him was enough to bring on tears. A woman was cooking over a fire in the blackened hearth, and spared Temple one sour look as he entered. The counter was a warped slab with a fresh split down its length and a large stain worked into the grain that looked unpleasantly like blood. Behind it, the tavern keep was carefully wiping cups with a rag.
"It's not too late," whispered Temple. "We could just choke down a cup of whatever piss they sell here, walk straight on through, and no harm done. Until the rest of the company get here. I meant no harm to us."
But Sophine was already approaching the counter, leaving Temple to curse silently in the doorway for a moment before following with the greatest reluctance.
"What can I get for you?" asked the keep.
"There are some 400 mercenaries surrounding your town with every intention of attacking," said Sophine.
And Temple's hopes of avoiding catastrophe were dealt a shattering blow. There was a pregnant pause, heavily pregnant.
"This hasn't been my best week," grunted the keep. "I'm in no mood for jokes."
"If we were set on laughter, I think we could come up with better," muttered Temple.
Sophine spoke over him.
"They are the company of the Gracious Hand, led by the infamous mercenary Nikomokoska, and they have been employed by His Majesty's Inquisition to root out rebels in the near country. Unless they receive your fullest cooperation, your bad week will get a great deal worse."
They had the keep's attention now. They had the attention of every person in the tavern, and were not likely to lose it. Whether that was a good thing remained very much to be seen, but Temple was not optimistic. He could not remember the last time he had been.
"And if there is rebels in town?"
The farmer leaned against the counter beside them, pointedly rolling up his sleeve. There was a tattoo on his sinewy forearm. Freedom, liberty, justice. Here, then, was the scourge of the mighty Union. Lawson's insidious enemy, the terrifying rebel in the flesh. Temple looked into his eyes. If this was the face of evil, it was a haggard one. Sufeen chose his words carefully.
Then they have less than an hour to surrender and spare the people of this town bloodshed.
The bony man gave a smile, missing several of the teeth and all of the joy.
I can take you to Sheel. He can choose what to believe.
Clearly, he did not believe any of it, or perhaps even entirely comprehend.
Take us to Sheel, then, said Sufeen. Good.
Is it?
Muttered Temple. The feeling of impending disaster was almost choking him now, or perhaps that was the rebel's breath. He certainly had the breath of evil, if nothing else.
You'll have to give up your weapons, he said. With the greatest respect, said Temple, I'm not convinced. Hand 'em over.
Temple was surprised to see the woman at the fire had produced a loaded flat bow and was pointing it unwavering at him.
I am convinced, he croaked, pulling his knife from his belt between finger and thumb. It's only a very small one.
Ain't the size, said the bony man, as he plucked it from Temple's hand, so much as where you stick it.
Sufeen unbuckled his sword belt, and he took that too.
Let's go, and it'd be an idea not to make no sudden moves.
Temple raised his palms.
I try always to avoid them.
You made one when you followed me down here, as I recall, said Sufeen.
And how I regret it now.
Shut up.
The bony rebel herded them towards the door, the woman following at a cautious distance, bow leveled. Temple caught the blue of a tattoo on the inside of her wrist. The boy lurched along at the back, one of his legs in a brace, and his satchel clutched tight to his chest. It might have been a laughable procession without the threat of death. Temple had always found the threat of death to be a sure antidote to comedy. Sheel turned out to be the old man who had watched them walk into town a few moments before. What happy times those seemed now. He stiffly stood, waving away a fly, then, almost as an afterthought, even more stiffly, bent for his sword before stepping from his porch.
"What's to do, Dannard?"
he asked in a voice croaky with phlegm.
"Caught these two in the inn," said the bony man.
"Caught?" asked Temple.
"We walked in and asked for you."
"Shut up," said Dannard.
"You shut up," said Sufeen.
Sheel did something between vomiting and clearing his throat, then effortfully swallowed the results.
Let's all see if we can split the difference between talking too much and not at all. I'm Sheel. I speak for the rebels hereabouts.
All four of them? Asked Temple.
There were more.
He looked sad rather than angry. He looked all squeezed out, and, one could only hope, ready to give up.
My name is Sufeen, and I have come to warn you.
We're surrounded, apparently, sneered Dannard. Surrender to the Inquisition, and Avastok stands another day.
Sheel turned his watered-down grey eyes on Temple.
You'd have to agree, it's a far-fetched story.
Easy, hard. It mattered not what crooked path they'd followed here. There was only one way through this now, and that was to convince this man of what they said. Temple fixed him with his most earnest expression, the one with which he had convinced Cardia he would not steal again, with which he had convinced his wife that everything would be well, with which he had told Koska he could be trusted. Had they not all believed him?
My friend is telling you the truth.
He spoke slowly, carefully, as if there were only the two of them there.
Come with us, and we can save lives.
He's lying.
The bony man poked Temple in the side with the pommel of Sufine's sword.
There ain't no one up there.
Why would we come here just to lie?
Temple ignored the prodding and kept his eyes fixed on the old man's wasted face.
What would we gain?
Why do it at all?
Asked Sheel. Temple paused for a moment, his mouth half open. Why not the truth? At least it was novel.
We got sick of not doing it.
Ah.
That appeared to touch something. The old man's hand drifted from his sword hilt. Not surrender, a long way from surrender, but something.
If you're telling the truth, and we give up, what then?
Too much truth is always a mistake. Temple stuck to earnest.
The people of Avastok will be spared. That I promise you.
The old man cleared his throat again. God, his lungs sounded bad. Could it be that he was starting to believe? Could it be that this might actually work? Might they not only live out the day, but save lives into the bargain? Might he do something that Cardia would have been proud of? The thought made Temple proud, just for a moment. He ventured a smile. When did he last feel proud? Had he ever? Sheel opened his mouth to speak, to concede, to surrender, then paused, frowning off over Temple's shoulder. A sound carried on the wind ever so faintly. Hooves. Horses' hooves. Temple followed the old rebel's gaze and saw, up on the grassy side of the valley, a rider coming down at a full gallop. Sheel saw him too, and his forehead furrowed with puzzlement. More riders appeared behind the first, pouring down the slope, now a dozen, now more.
No,
muttered Temple.
Temple,
hissed Sufine. Sheel's eyes widened.
You bastards!
Temple held up his hand.
No!
He heard grunting in his ear, and when Temple turned to tell Sufine this was hardly the time, saw his friend and Danard lurching about in a snarling embrace. He stared at them, open-mouthed. They should have had an hour. Sheel clumsily drew his sword, metal scraping, and Temple caught his hand before he could swing it and butted him in the face. There was no thought, it just happened. The world jolted, Sheel's crackly breath warm on his cheek. They tussled and tore, and a fist hit the side of Temple's face and made his ears ring. He butted again, felt nosebone pop against his forehead, and suddenly Sheel was stumbling back, and Sufine was standing beside Temple with the sword in his hands and looking very surprised that he had it. Temple stood a moment, trying to work out how they had got here, then what they should do now. He heard a flat bowstring, the whisper of a bolt passing, maybe. Then he saw Danard struggling up.
You fucking...
And his head came apart. Temple blinked, blood across his face, saw Sheel reaching for a knife. Sufine stabbed at him, and the old man gave a croaking cough as the metal slid into his side, clutched at himself, face twisted, blood leaking between his fingers. He muttered something Temple couldn't understand, and tried to draw his knife again, and the sword caught him just above the eye.
"Oh!"
he said, blood washing out of the big slit in his forehead and down his face.
"Oh!"
Drops sprinkled the mud as he staggered sideways, bounced off his own porch, and fell, rolling over, back arching, one hand flapping. Sufine stared down at him.
"We were going to save people,"
he muttered. There was blood on his lips. He dropped to his knees, and the sword bounced out of his limp hand. Temple grabbed at him.
"What?"
The knife he had handed over to Danard was buried in Sufine's ribs to the grip, his shirt quickly turning black. A very small knife by most standards, but more than big enough. That dog was still barking. Sufine toppled forward onto his face. The woman with the flat bow had gone. Was she reloading somewhere? Would she pop up ready to shoot again? Temple should probably have taken cover. He didn't move. The sound of hooves grew louder. Blood spread out in a muddy puddle around Sheel's split head. The boy slowly backed away, broke into a waddling trot, dragging his crippled leg after. Temple watched him go. Then Joubert rounded the side of the inn, mud flicking from the hooves of his great horse, sword raised high. The boy tried to turn again, lurched one more desperate step, before the blade caught him in the shoulder and spun him across the street. Joubert tore past, shouting something. More horsemen followed. People were running, screaming, faint over the rumble of hooves. They should have had an hour. Temple knelt beside Sophine, reached out to turn him over, check his wounds, tear off a bandage, do those things Cardia had taught him long ago. But as soon as he saw Sophine's face, he knew he was dead. Mercenaries charged through the town, howling like a pack of dogs, waving weapons as though they were winning cards in a game. He could smell smoke. Temple picked up Shiel's sword, notched blade, red-speckled now, stood and walked over to the lame boy. He was crawling towards the inn, one arm useless. He saw Temple and whimpered, clutching handfuls of muck with his good hand. His satchel had come open, and coins were spilling out, silver scattered in the mud.
"Help me," whispered the boy. "Help me."
"No."
"They'll kill me! They'll—"
"Shut your fucking mouth!" Temple poked the boy in the back with the sword, and he gulped and cowered, and the more he cowered, the more Temple wanted to stick the sword through him. It was surprisingly light. It would have been so easy to do. The boy saw it in his face, and whined and cringed more, and Temple poked him again.
"Shut your mouth, fucker! Shut your mouth! Temple! Are you all right?"
Koska loomed over him on his tall grey.
"You're bleeding."
Temple looked down and saw his shirt sleeve was ripped, blood trickling down the back of his hand. He was not sure how that had happened.
"Sophine is dead," he mumbled. "Why do the fates always take the best of us?"
But Koska's attention had been hooked by the glint of money in the mud. He held out a hand to Friendly, and the sergeant helped him down from his gilt saddle. The old man stooped, fishing one of the coins up between two fingers, eagerly rubbing the muck away, and he produced that luminous smile of which only he was capable, good humour and good intentions radiating from his deep-lined face.
"Yes,"
Temple heard him whisper. Friendly tore the satchel from the boy's back and jerked it open. A faint jingle spoke of more coins inside. Thump, 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 as a group of mercenaries kicked at the door of the inn. One hopped away, cursing, pulling his filthy boot off to nurse his toes. Koska squatted down.
"Where did this money come from?"
"We went on a raid," muttered the boy. "All went wrong."
There was a crash as the inn's door gave, a volley of cheering as men poured through the open doorway.
"All went wrong?"
"Only four of us made it back, so we had 24 horses to trade. Man called Gregor Cantless bought 'em off us up in Greyer."
"Cantless?"
Shutters shattered as a chair was flung through the window of the inn and tumbled across the street beside them. Friendly frowned towards the hole it left, but Koska did not so much as twitch, as though there was nothing in the world but him and the boy and the coins.
"What sort of man was this Cantless? A rebel?"
"No. He had nice clothes, some crazy-eyed Northman with him. He took the horses, and he paid with those coins."
"Where did he get them?"
"Didn't say."
Koska peeled up the sleeve on the boy's limp arm to show his tattoo.
"But he definitely wasn't one of you rebels."
The boy only shook his head.
"That answer will not make Inquisitor Lawson happy."
Koska gave a nod so gentle it was almost imperceptible. Friendly put his hands around the boy's neck. That dog was still barking somewhere. Bark, bark, bark. Temple wished someone would shut it up. Across the street, three Cantics were savagely beating a man, while a pair of children watched.
We should stop them, muttered Temple,
but all he did was sit down in the road.
How?
Koska had more of the coins in his hand, was carefully sorting through them.
I'm a general, not a god. Many generals get mixed up on that point, but I was cured of the misapprehension long ago, believe me.
A woman was dragged screaming from a nearby house by her hair.
The men are upset. Like a flood, it's safer to wash with the current than try to dam it up. If they don't have a channel for their anger, why, it could flow anywhere, even over me.
He grunted as Friendly helped him up to standing.
And it's not as though any of this was my fault, is it?
Temple's head was throbbing. He felt so tired he could hardly move.
It was mine. I know you meant well.
Flames were already hungrily licking at the eaves of the inn's roof.
But that's how it is with good intentions. Hopefully we've all learned a lesson here today.
Koska produced a flask and started thoughtfully unscrewing the cap.
I about indulging you, you about indulging yourself.
And he upended it and steadily swallowed.
You're drinking again? Muttered Temple. You fuss too much. A nip never hurt anyone.
Koska sucked the last drops out and tossed the empty flask to Friendly for a refill.
Inquisitor Lawson, so glad you could join us.
I hold you responsible for this debacle, snapped Lawson as he reined his horse up savagely in the street.
It's far from my first, said the old man. I shall have to live with the shame.
This hardly seems a moment for jokes.
Koska chuckled.
My old commander, Sazine, once told me, you should laugh every moment you live, for you'll find it decidedly difficult afterward. These things happen in war. I've a feeling there was some confusion with the signals. However carefully you plan, there are always surprises.
As if to illustrate the point, a Gurkish mercenary capered across the street, wearing the bard's beribboned jacket.
But this boy was able to tell us something before he died.
Silver glinted in Koska's gloved palm.
Imperial coins, given to these rebels by a man called...
Gregor Kentlis,
put in Friendly.
That was it, in the town of Greya.
Lawson frowned hard.
Are you saying the rebels have imperial funding? Superior Pike was very clear that we avoid any entanglements with the Empire.
Koska held a coin up to the light.
You see this face? Emperor Ostus II. He died some 1400 years ago.
I did not know you were such a keen devotee of history, said Lawson.
I am a keen devotee of money. These are ancient coins. Perhaps the rebels stumbled upon a tomb. The great men of old were sometimes buried with their riches.
The great men of old do not concern us, said Lawson. It's today's rebels we're after.
A pair of Union mercenaries were screaming at a man on his knees, asking him where the money was. One of them hit him with a length of wood torn from his own shattered door, and when he got groggily up, there was blood running down his face. They asked him again. They hit him again. Slap, slap, slap. Swarbrick, the biographer, watched them with one hand over his mouth.
Dear me,
he muttered between his fingers.
Like everything else, Koska was explaining, rebellion costs money. Food, clothes, weapons, shelter. Fanatics still need what the rest of us need. A little less of it, since they have their high ideals to nourish them, but the point stands. Follow the money, find the leaders. Greya appears on Superior Pike's list anyway, does it not? And perhaps this Cantlers can lead us to this Contus of yours.
Lawson perked up at that.
Conthus.
Besides,
Koska gestured at the rebels' corpses with a loose waft of his sword that nearly took Swarbrick's nose off.
I doubt we'll be getting any further clues from these three. Life rarely turns out the way we expect. We must bend with the circumstances.
Lawson gave a disgusted grunt. Very well. For now, we follow the money. He turned his horse about and shouted to one of his practicals. Search the corpses for tattoos, dammit. Find me any rebels still alive. 3 doors down, a man had climbed onto the roof of a house and was stuffing bedding down the chimney, while others clustered about the door. Koska, meanwhile, was holding forth to Swarbrick.
I share your distaste for this, believe me. I have been closely involved in the burning of some of the world's most ancient and beautiful cities. You should have seen Opreel in flames. It lit the sky for miles. This is scarcely a career highlight.
Joubert had dragged some corpses into a line and was expressionlessly cutting their heads off. Thud, 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 went his heavy sword. 2 of his men had torn apart the arch over the road and were whittling the ends of the timbers to points. 1 was already rammed into the ground and had Shiel's head on it, mouth strangely pouting.
"Dear me,"
muttered Swarbrick again.
"Severed heads," Koska was explaining, "never go out of fashion. Used sparingly and with artistic sensibility, they can make a point a great deal more eloquently than those still attached. Make a note of that. Why aren't you writing?"
An old woman had crawled from the burning house, face stained with soot, and now some of the men had formed a circle and were shoving her tottering back and forth. "What a waste," Lawson was bitterly complaining to one of his practicals. "How fine this land could be with the proper management, with firm governance and the latest techniques of agriculture and forestry. They have a threshing machine now in Middleland, which can do in a day with one operator what used to take 12 peasants a week." "What do the other 11 do?" asked Temple, his mouth seeming to move by itself. "Find other employment," snarled the practical. Behind him, another head went up on its stick, long hair stirring. Temple did not recognize the face. The smoked-out house was burning merrily now, flames whipping, air shimmering, the men backing off with hands up against the heat, letting the old woman crawl away.
"Find other employment," muttered Temple to himself.
Koska had Braccio by the elbow and was shouting in his ear over the noise.
"You need to round up your men. We must head north and east towards Greya and seek out news of this Gregor Cantlis."
"It might take a while to calm 'em."
"1 hour, then I ask Sergeant Friendly to bring in the stragglers in pieces if necessary. Discipline, Swarbrick, is vital to a body of fighting men."
Temple closed his eyes. God, it stank. Smoke and blood and fury and smoke. He needed water. He turned to ask Safine for some and saw his corpse in the mud a few strides away. A man of principle must make hard choices and suffer the consequences.
"We brought your horse down," said Koska,
as though that should make up for at least some of the day's reverses.
"If you want my advice, keep busy. Put this place at your back as swiftly as possible."
"How do I forget this?"
"Oh, that's too much to ask. The trick is in learning to just..."
Koska stepped carefully back as one of the Styrians rode whooping past, a man's corpse bouncing after his horse.
"Not care."
"I have to bury Safine."
"Yes, I suppose so. But quickly, we have daylight and not a moment to waste. Joubert, put that down."
And the old man started across the street, waving his sword.
"Burn anything that still needs burning and mount up. We're moving east."
When Temple turned, Friendly was wordlessly offering him a shovel. The dog had finally stopped barking. A big Northman, a tattooed brute from past the crinner, had spiked its head on a spear beside the heads of the rebels and was pointing up at it, chuckling. Temple took Safine by the wrists and hauled him onto his shoulder, then up and over the saddle of his scared horse. Not an easy task, but easier than he had expected. Living, Sufine had been big with talk and movement and laughter. Dead, he was hardly any weight at all.
"Are you all right?"
Burmy, touching him on the arm. His concern made Temple want to cry.
"I'm not hurt, but Sufine is dead."
There was justice. Two of the Northmen had smashed open a chest of drawers and were fighting over the clothes inside, leaving torn cloth scattered across the muddy street. The tattooed man had tied a stick below the dog's head and was carefully arranging a best shirt with a frilly front upon it, face fixed with artist's concentration.
"You sure you're all right?"
Burmy called after him from the midst of the rubbish-strewn street.
"Never better."
Temple led the horse out of town, then off the track, or the two strips of rutted mud that passed for one. The sounds of barked orders and burning, and the men reluctantly making ready to leave, fading behind him, to be replaced by chattering water. He followed the river upstream until he found a pleasant enough spot between two trees, their hanging boughs trailing in the water. He slid Sufine's body down and rolled it over onto its back.
"I'm sorry," he said, and tossed the shovel into the river.
Then he pulled himself up into his saddle. Sufine would not have cared where he was laid out or how. If there was a god, he was with him now, probably demanding to know why he had so conspicuously failed as yet to put the world to rights. "North and east," Koska had said. Temple turned his horse towards the west, and gave it his heels, and galloped off, away from the greasy pall of smoke rising from the ruins of Avastok, away from the company of the Gracious Hand, away from Dimbic and Braccio and Joubert, away from Inquisitor Lawson and his righteous mission. He had no destination in mind, anywhere but with Nicomo Koska. New Lives.
"And there's the Fellowship," said Sweet, reining in with forearms on saddle horn and fingers dangling.
The wagons were strung out for a mile or so along the bottom of the valley. 30 or more, some covered with stained canvas, some painted bright colours, dots of orange and purple and twinkling gilt jumping from the dusty brown landscape. Specks of walkers alongside them, riders up ahead. At the back came the beasts, horses, spare oxen, a good-sized herd of cattle, and following hard after a swelling cloud of dust, tugged by the breeze and up into the blue to announce the Fellowship's coming to the world.
"Will you look at that?"
Leif kicked his horse forward, standing in his stirrups with a grin all the way across his face.
"Just see that!"
Shai hadn't seen him smile before, and it made him look young, more boy than man, which he probably was. Made her smile herself.
"I see it,"
she said.
"A whole town on the move!"
"True, it's a fair cross-section through society," said Sweet, shifting his old arse in his saddle. "Some honest, some sharp, some rich, some poor, some clever, and some not so much. Lots of prospectors, some herders and some farmers, few merchants, all set on a new life out there beyond the horizon. We even got the first of the Magi down there."
Lamb's head jerked around.
"What?" "A famous actor, Josef Lestek. His buyers mesmerized the crowd in Adua, apparently."
Sweet gave his gravelly chuckle.
"About 100 bloody years ago. He's hoping to bring theatre to the far country, I hear. But between you, me, and half the population of the Union, his powers are well on the wane."
"Don't convince us Baez anymore, eh?" asked Shai.
"He scarcely convinces me as Josef Lestek," Sweet shrugged. "But what do I know about acting?"
"Even your dab Sweet's no better than passable."
Let's get down there, said Leif. Get us a better look.
There was a less romantic feel to the business at close quarters, isn't there to every business. That number of warm bodies, man and beast, produced a quantity of waste hardly to be credited, and certainly not to be smelled without good cause. The smaller and less glamorous animals, dogs and flies chiefly, though undoubtedly lice too, didn't stand out from a distance, but made double the impression once you were in the midst. Shai was forced to wonder whether the fellowship might in fact be a brave but foolhardy effort to export the worst evils of city living into the middle of the unspoiled wilderness. Not blind to this, some of the senior fellows had removed themselves a good 50 strides from the main body in order to consider the course, meaning argue over it and grab a drink, and were now scratching their heads over a big map.
"Step away from that map before you hurt yourselves," called Sweet as they rode up. "I'm back, and you're 3 valleys south of the course."
"Only 3? Better than I dared hope."
A tall, sinewy Cantic with a fine-shaped skull, bald as an egg, stepped up, giving Shai and Lamb and Leaf a careful look-over on the way.
"You have friends along."
"This here is Lamb and his daughter Shai."
She didn't bother to correct him on the technicality.
"This lad's name, I must confess, has for the time being slipped from my clutches."
"Leif."
"That was it. This here is my employer."
Sweet said the word like even admitting its existence was too much cramping of his freedoms.
"An unrepentant criminal by the name of Abram Mahood."
"A pleasure to make your acquaintances."
Mahood displayed much good humour and a golden front tooth as he bowed to each of them.
"And I assure you I have been repenting ever since I formed this fellowship."
His dark eyes took on a faraway look, as though he was gazing back across the long miles travelled.
"Back in Keln along with my partner Kernsbeck, a hard man, but a clever one. He has invented a portable forge, among other things. I'm taking it to Kreis with the intention of founding a metalwork business. We might also look into staking some mining claims in the mountains."
"Gold?" asked Shai.
"Iron and copper."
Mahood leaned in to speak softly.
"In my most humble opinion, only fools think there is gold in gold. Are the 3 of you minded to join up with our fellowship?"
"That we are," said Shai. "We've business of our own in Kreis."
"All are welcome. The rate for buying in—"
"Lamb here is a serious fighting man,"
cut in Sweet. Mahood paused, lips pressed into an appraising line.
"Without offence, he looks a little old."
"No one'll be arguing on that score," said Lamb. "I lack the freshest bloom myself," added Sweet. "You're no toddler if it comes to that. If it's youth you want, the lad with them is well supplied."
Mahood looked still less impressed by Leif.
"I seek a happy medium."
Sweet snorted.
"Well, you won't find many of them out here. We don't get enough fighters. With the ghosts fixed on blood, it's no time to be cutting costs. Believe me, old Sanjeed wouldn't stop to argue prices with you. Lamb's in, or I'm out. And you can scout your way round in circles till your wagons fall apart."
Mahood looked up at Lamb, and Lamb looked back, still and steady. Seemed he'd left his weak eye back in Square Deal. A few moments to consider, and Mahood had seen what he needed to.
"Then Master Lamb goes free. 2 paid shares comes to—"
Sweet scratched, wincing at the back of his neck.
"I've made a deal with Shai. They'd all 3 come free."
Mahood's eyes shifted to her with what might have been grudging respect.
"It would appear she got the better of that particular negotiation."
"I'm a scout, not a trader."
"Perhaps you should be leaving the trading to those of us who are."
"I traded a damn sight better than you've scouted, by all appearances."
Mahood shook his fine-shaped head.
"I have no notion of how I will explain this to my partner Kernsbeck."
He walked off, wagging one long finger.
Kernsbeek is not a man to be trifled with on expenses.
By the dead, grumbled Sweet. Did you ever hear such carping? Anyone would think we'd set out with a company of women.
Looks like you have, said Shy. One of the